and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximise your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Welcome back, everybody, to another edition of the Triathlon Coach Swapcast. My name is Simon Ward, your weekly host for this triathlon extravaganza, if you like to call it. And today, we've got a returning guest, a man I'm really excited to chat with, and I know that you'll be excited to hear from him. And hopefully, by the end of it, you'll be excited to read his new book. So, firstly, welcome to the show, Mr. Mike Riley, the voice of Ironman.
Well, thanks for having me back, Simon. I must have done okay the first time around, or not okay, and you want to do better this time around.
Well, I seem to remember you sending me an email, Mike, begging to be on the show to talk about your new book. So I had to let you in, didn't I? I found a space for you amongst all my other guests.
I beg well.
You most certainly do. Now, before we get going, you were good enough, actually, to sign a copy of your new book, and somebody sent me a photograph of it, and as per some of the words, which I'm not going to divulge all of them, but I have done my preparation this time, as requested. In the inscription you wrote on the inside of the book, you asked me to do my preparation, so you'll be pleased to know that I've done it. I've read the book, and I've made my notes, like a good announcer.
Okay, good.
So listen,
I wanted to make sure, you know, you were ready.
Yeah, so I sat and read this book from start to finish, Mike, and I was engrossed, I have to say. The stories just blew my mind. And I suppose my first question was, well, you started announcing at Kona in 1989, so nearly 40 years of doing that announcing, and not to mention all the other events in between then. You must have so many stories. I guess the first question is, how did you decide what was going to go in? And how did you decide what to leave out?
That was a tough part. You know, there are stories that are left out of the book that I wish I didn't have to, but you can just go so long, you know, so many stories in a book. The ones that are in there, I just, at the end of the day, I just felt very close to. They affected me. They inspired me. They motivated me. When I think about them, when I'm not having a great day, they bring me up. So I had to go on that personal side of it, on which stories I chose, because it's the only way I could make that decision. And then, I just would hope that others would be as inspired as I have been by them. So that's how I chose.
Yeah, and I have to say, and I'm sure other people will have done and will do when they read it. I laughed alongside some of the stories. I have to admit, I cried a couple of times as well. I mean, I'm around inspirational people like you are, because I work with some of these athletes, not all the ones you've mentioned, but I work with people like them, and they inspire me as a coach and in my own athletic disputes. And I was also I got a bit depressed at some of the sadness in the lives of some people. But then as you went on in the story, then that sadness and depression is sort of overtaken by the inspiration and the joy at reading of their, you know, the outcome in the end. You talked about how you were inspired, but do you think that the experiences that you've acquired through meeting these people and seeing what they've done has guided the way you live your life?
100%. You know, my life's always been built around family first, and which I think gives you a tremendous amount of strength if you're close to your family. And then I've just been very fortunate, Simon. I've got a second family. And it's when I go to an event, they're all there. Everybody shows up. So when I talk to people, when I look into their eyes, when they tell me their story, and like I've even said in the book, I don't know everybody's backstory, but I know there's one there. So, when I think when people like yourself read the book and others, we're all at certain spots in our life at that time. And you may read the Matt Long story or the Blaze story or the Kristen story, and it affects you a little bit differently because of where you're standing right now compared to that next person. But when I saw those things happen, and a month later when I think about them, or a year later, gosh dang, I just can't believe what she went through and what she survived and how she's still surviving. What am I bitching and complaining about? So it's affected me and it's affecting others, from what people are telling me when they read it in a good, positive way, even though the stories are sometimes tough to read.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, some of those letters that you've received from people, the one from the lady you refer to as Lynn Mills, where she said that you saved her life. I mean, that must have taken you a few goes to get through that letter.
When you read, when someone sends you part of their suicide note to their family, that's way beyond anything I've ever been prepared for, or way beyond this as an Ironman world. It was just a huge piece of life that someone wanted to take away, and to, the grace above and whatever it took, she didn't, and she's still with us. And did Iron Man do it completely? No. Did I do it completely? Absolutely not. But for some reason, everything lined up for her so that she's still with us today and thriving and doing well. Still battling some demons, as a lot of us could be or are, but she's still with us. So, and one thing, Simon, I didn't want to like try to teach lesson. Nobody wants to be taught a lesson. We're all adults. We can figure out the lesson that needs to be learned for our own lives. So when you try to teach someone a lesson, it may not pertain to them at that particular point. So that's why I didn't try to, I just wanted the lessons to come out at you and kind of hit you between the eyes and wake you up, which I think they will do.
Well, they most certainly did. And probably with each of those stories that you told, I suppose I could think about my own experiences preparing for a race and think, my leg hurts a bit. I'm not sure if I can train today, or I've got this, I'm getting over this knee operation. Should I give it another week? Maybe I'll leave it until next year. And then you read about the people who, Scott Rigsby, who's, lost both of his both of his legs in an accident, and some of the things that he has to go through on a daily basis, and it sort of put things into perspective, doesn't it? In how each of us, I mean, of course, in our own situations, the problems we have are big in our minds in each of our situations. But when you read about what some people go to, it sort of enables you to put it into perspective and maybe gives you that inspiration and willpower to move forwards.
That's why I. At first, as I said in my final chapter, I wanted to write this book to our world, the Ironman triathlon, the endurance sports world. But it became evident to me that people from outside of our sport who have come into it have been healed in many ways. This book is really for everybody because, we wake up in the morning and we don't want to go to work, or we've got a boss that's, we don't like, or we can't get along with, or we're having a tough time with a relationship, whether it's our partner, spouse, or kid. And, those are just the regular things in life that beat you down. And sure, can doing an Ironman pull you out of that stuff? No, it's got to be a complete balance thing. When I dove into these stories and talked to people and saw what happened, I said, this is a life book. Sure, it's based around an endurance event, because that's what I do and who I am. But it's a book about even getting out of, I don't tell people in the book that, you got to do an Ironman, you'll be healed. All I say is without saying it, get your ass off the couch and walk around the block, you know, start figuring out that relationship with your kid, get some help, get some advice, you know, start moving down a path that you hopefully will be healed with and someone else will be too.
Those listeners who've done an Ironman or done a challenging ultra distance event will know that that event is a metaphor for life. You know, you have good bits, you have bad bits, you have highs, you have lows. At times it seems like it's easy and at times it feels like you're not making any progress or going backwards. But then as I was reading your book, I thought that the whole sport of triathlon and you know, some of the chapters in your book are a metaphor for life, really. So, you know, you talk about one chapter where about having a reason, how everybody has a reason, a reason why. There's other bits in there where you talk about some of the pros you've met and some of those that you've been inspired by, you know, about the way they live their life as ambassadors for that healthy lifestyle. There's inspiration. There's stories of never giving up. And there's stories about people setting a goal and working towards it. So I think, you know, I'd agree that this is truly a book about how to move forward with your life and sort of approach and try to overcome every obstacle, really, if you can find a way.
Yeah. And you know, there are a lot of great books out there about endurance athletes or business leaders, whatever, you know, and it's a singular about them because, you know, they could have won a world championship or a gold medal or CEO of a major corporation. And those books are interesting to read, but it's one life. And that's why I wanted to put something like this together, because the books, I don't want it to be about me. I go into the, you know, background and things like that because people are always asking me. So I wanted to be able to answer those questions. But I've got so many individual stories in here. And it's, you know, I've had the honor and pleasure to be able to be close to them. And not a lot of people out there are close to this many stories, you know, seeing what I see and being where I'm at. So I wanted to make sure that I just did as good a job as possible as passing these stories on. And it wasn't easy. I mean, it, you know, like I said at the beginning, what do you choose? So I just chose what was close to me and passed those on.
I mean, you know, I mentioned a moment ago that when I was reading some of those stories, I had a lump in my throat on quite a few occasions, and on a couple of occasions, I found myself mopping up some tears. I know we spoke before in the previous podcast, and for those people who haven't listened, I'll make a reference to that in the show notes so they can listen to the story about how you got into this and became an announcer. But you did mention in that conversation how when you're there in the moment in the announcing tower, or you at Clearwater and John Blaze is there and you're reading out his letter, that you're able to keep it together because there's that element of professional, you know, character that you get into. But what about when you were writing the book? Surely there must have been moments when you had to sort of just take a breath and pause for a moment.
The biggest thing about writing the book is when I was writing down the story and looking at old notes that I had and things like that, I would recall something else and I'd go, oh my gosh, I remember that. And it would add to the story because it was part of the story. So I felt it, you know, I tried to step on the outside writing and, but there were emotional points. The toughest for me, Simon, was when I read the audio book and read this book and had to do it in a professional manner because obviously it's an audio book and hard to get through the chapters about Grace or Mike Ergo or, you know, it's hard to get through some of those, but that's why, you know, this book isn't all sad stories and tears. There's a lot of stuff in there. I, you know, laughing at myself and laughing at others. And, you know, my first welcome to Australia, as you remember, or, you know, our poor Japanese athletes taking his wetsuit off in Lake Placid and not having anything on underneath in front of the crowd. And, oh, my God. So I've seen some stuff that will make a lot of people laugh. And people that are there, were there, will remember it vividly.
You did make me laugh a few times as well. I can, you know, I've done some announcing myself and I could imagine those situations as they're happening in front of us and you're not sure whether to describe what's going on and try and talk about something else or whether you're just stuck for words. What did you do in the situation? I can't remember what you did in the situation with the Japanese guy in Lake Placid. Did you divert everyone's attention?
Oh God, no. I mean, it was, I'm one of the crowd. Think about it. Even though I got the microphone in my hand, when you see something for the first time with everybody else and he stands up and you got to be kidding me. I mean, I think I even laughed a little over the microphone and then everybody lost it. And then he tried putting the suit back on, which was fruitless. And he just covered himself up and ran up and had a big smile on his face. So everybody ended up, you know, I was just like everybody else going, oh my gosh, I didn't divert anything. We were just, you know, we were all watching it. So
you said that was 1990. You said that was 1999, didn't you? That event. So that would have been the first. That would have been the first edition of Lake Placid.
Yeah, the very first year in Placid.
I was actually there that year racing. So
wow!
I would have been one of those guys. I would have been one of those guys. Yeah, I actually found the medal the other day and thought, oh well, that must have been the first one. And so yeah, I must have been one of those guys. And as I recall, the T1. It was a bit of a run. You had to run out of the area where the lake was and up some of the streets into town and into the center of the ice skating rink at the high school. Is that right?
Yeah, he had a bit of a run after the wetsuit was off to get up there. It's probably, it's one of the longer ones in the world. There's no doubt. You know, it's a good 800 yards. I mean, it's a good run.
Yeah. And for the Japanese, of course, it's all about, it's all about this pride as well, isn't it? And respect and self. So that would have been even more embarrassing for him, I guess.
Yeah, but he you know, it turned on him real quick. He just laughed like everybody else did and went about his business. So he, oh gosh, I can still see it. Well, not much of it. Not much of it. The water was cold.
It was, yeah. Yeah, I'll come back to some of these other stories a bit later, Mike. But I just wanted to ask, when going back to some of the, you know, the stories where you go into a great deal of depth about somebody's backstory. I read in your book you make a big point at the beginning about doing your research and going through the race numbers and looking at who significant people are and trying to find out a little bit more about them. But do you if they've alluded to some of their backstory, do you make an effort to find out about more of that before the event, or these stories that you've told, are they built up by what you've learned about the people after you've called them across the line and because you've got to know them a bit better?
Yeah, a lot of it is there's obviously pre-stuff where if I've talked to the athlete before the race, I start learning about it, and then you learn even more afterwards. But a lot of stories I learn about afterwards. I mean, I know that they're racing or they may have had this cancer or this something to them and they're getting to the finish line and I bring them in with that. And I don't know. I've always I've always wanted to stay close to a lot of people within the sport to see how they're doing beyond that race day and whether they'd come back to do another one and things like that. So it's pretty amazing. I've got some great relationships with a lot of people in the sport that over the years that I've talked to and brought in and I'll see somebody 15 years later, Simon, and go, oh my gosh, Jimmy, how you doing, buddy? I'm great. You know, the family's great. And the cancer, I'm absolutely 100% cancer free. And I remember every moment with that. And I go, gosh, that's fantastic. So, you know, it's as hokey as it sounds sometimes, it's just me, you know, wondering how that cousin is or wondering how that long lost friend's doing, like we all do in life. And I just have a lot of them out there. And, you know, sometimes it does get a little bit overwhelming because I wish I could be a part of everybody's, you know, not life, but struggles and know how they're doing. But you just, obviously, it's a big number, so it's hard to do. But I have more in my head than you can imagine when it comes to when I start remembering things.
Oh, I can. I've got a memory like that, and sometimes it's overwhelming. It sort of does my head in a bit that I can remember all this stuff because then I'm, you know, I can probably like you. I see somebody's face and I know that they're who they are, and I can remember bits about them, but I can't remember their name.
Exactly.
And it, you know, that yeah. I wish I could. I need that sort of. Like Bill Clinton used to have that little guy with the earpiece telling, this is Bob, he's from here. You know, hi, Bob, how you doing?
Yeah, we don't have that.
So, no, we do not. But, I mean, I you know, I've my first Ironman was Canada in 1995. So I've been doing this thing for not quite as long as you, but for a long time. And when I started doing Ironmans, there was still about 7 or 8 in the world. They were very unique. You know, if you had a tattoo on your shoulder, on your on your arm or somewhere. It was quite a niche group of people, and you'd meet somebody in the street who saw your tattoo and they'd say hello and you'd get chatting and you wouldn't know them from Adam. And of course that the sport and the industry and the brand of Ironman has exploded massively in those 25 years, as you have experienced as well. And I know a lot of people find that distasteful, but for me, if you look below that commercial layer, what you mentioned a moment ago about it being a family is that everybody's still in that family. You know, when you've crossed the line and heard somebody shout, "You are an Ironman," whether it's you or Paul Kay or Pete Murray or anybody else, you do belong to a unique family. And for me, that transcends all the commercialism and everything else, because you become part of a family and you know what it's taken to get to that finish line. And somehow that's more important.
Yeah. And I said it in the book and I say it all the time. It's not about what they did that day. It's who they became. And you become someone else when you finish a race of that magnitude. Not only because of the event itself, but because of what you went through to even get to the start line. You know, people dissuade people from being so grandiose because they can't all be like that. So they push you down and, oh, you don't want to do that. Why? Come on out with me tonight. You know, what do you mean you're going for a long ride? You know, if they're not in that world with you, and it's tough. And so you just want to be able to stay as strong as you can and push through it all. And when they get to that finish line, you know, they become someone else, and people around them see it. You know, the old adage of your actions speak louder than words. When that mommy or daddy or that aunt or uncle come across the line and that, you know, 10-year-old or 11-year-old sees what they do, that's a huge influence. That's a bigger influence than being a mega movie star or songwriter or anything else. You're influencing that young person for the rest of their lives. And I tell athletes that all the time. You are inspirers. Don't discount that. Someone's seeing what you're doing today or what you're going through to get there, and they're being inspired by it. You may not even know who the heck they are. So, you know you are an inspirer.
I like the fact that you made a chapter about the Iron ladies and gents, the older athletes. I think 2017, when I did my legacy spot, I was invited by Simon Butterworth to go to that particular evening, and you came along with Diana and Andrew, and I think Cowman was there, some of those other older legends that you
better
about.
Better not old.
I think Kathleen McCartney came down. Julian Moss was there as well, and you know, you and Andrew stood up and you said a little bit about how these guys inspired you. It's always, you know, as I mentioned, I know the Brownies quite well. You know a lot of these elite athletes well, and I know you had your own athletic aspirations and you were a good marathon runner, but I think we all know that we can't be like these elite athletes. They have something slightly different, and so we could aspire. We could be inspired by them, but you know, we can aspire to be like these better athletes in their later years, the ones who are still going. I can still aspire to be out there training when I'm 60 or 70, and that's what makes these guys so special. They're still doing it. You know, Lou Hollander getting anaerobic every day and all of that stuff. It is inspirational and aspirational.
You know, the most inspirational part about it is they've created a lifestyle for themselves that they haven't wavered from. And we all go through ups and downs, and, you know, you may stop doing this or stop doing that or stop eating right, or, you know, but they have stayed on a path their entire lives. And look at them now. It's like, hey, look, you know, look at me now, if they could say that. They don't have those types of egos, but look, let me be your example. I'm 78 years old and I'm in the pool every day, or I'm doing something anaerobic every day, and I'm racing. I mean, Frank Farrar is 92. He still flies himself to sprint triathlons throughout the Midwest. Are you kidding me? And they've created that lifestyle for themselves, and they haven't wavered from it. That's the biggest lesson for me, is stick to it. You know, don't go through the ups and downs, you know, like a up and down dieter. I mean, it's just not good for you. What's good for you is keeping that strong path moving forward, and don't waver from it.
You mentioned Jim Ward in your book, I think he was one of the, was he the old, at one point he was the oldest ever finisher of an Ironman, wasn't he? I think. But Jim obviously has the same surname as me. And when I did Ironman Canada, he was, because they gave you numbers out based on alphabetical order, Jim Ward was the person I racked next to on my first race. And so we were putting our bikes up, and he, you know, like a gentleman officer that he was, he said, "Hey, how are you doing? And I said, "Oh, hello." And he said, "Are you a Ward as well?" And I said, "Yeah, I am, Simon Ward." And he said, "Oh, nice to meet you, brother." And so we got chatting, and I'm looking at this guy, and I'm looking at this old dude there and thinking, "Really, you doing this Ironman?" And I said, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but do you mind if I ask how old you were?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I'm only whatever, 70. And I'm like, "Whoa, man, that's good. I hope I'm still doing triathlon when I'm that age." And then he said, "So how many have you done?" I said, "Oh, this is my first one." So we spent a bit of time chatting, and you know, he gave me a bit of advice and told me where to start, told me to enjoy the race, said he'd see me at the finish line. And I saw him at the awards dinner, and then a few years later, I read about how he died while he was out mountain biking in Florida. And there was a few people posting how sad it was that he didn't die in the bosom of his family, you know, at home in his favorite armchair. And his son, who's also, son in the Marines as well? His son wrote in and said, "Hey, listen, my dad wouldn't have wanted it any other way. He loved mountain biking. He loved Florida and he loved the open air. And actually, he'd have been so upset if he'd died in an armchair. He would have much preferred to have been out on his mountain bike and just keeled over like he did." So that's, I suppose that summed up his attitude.
Well, you know, it's amazing. There's a lot of things in the book that I actually talk about, you know, is this fate or the stars aligned or whatever? And that's a definite story. If that was your first triathlon, Simon, and you racked your bike next to the great Jim Ward, from that day on, you should be to today counting your lucky stars. I mean, just think about that. I mean, he was an icon, and that's an amazing story.
Well, I always think that if somebody does you a good favor, you're in possession of that bit of niceness then, and your job's to pass it on to somebody else. And so, you know, I met Jim Ward at the start of my first Ironman. He gave me some advice, and I would hope that when I get to be 70 and I'm standing on the start line of an Ironman, I can meet and chat with a guy who's there, you know, a lot younger than me, doing it for the first time, and instill in him some thoughts and inspiration that enables him to,
exactly,
to sort of enjoy a good career. And then he's in possession of that, isn't he? And his job is to carry that along until he passes it on to somebody else. And so it goes.
Agreed.
So listen, Mike, let's talk about some of those stories. So the first one that I came to, right, was Peter Reed. You driving a van full of professional triathletes in a right-hand drive truck when you've never driven a right-hand drive truck before, when you were in Australia. And Mr. Reserved himself, the introverted Peter Reed, sat in the back talking to your young son, then Andy, and then giving him those running shoes, the ones that he, similar to, were they the exact ones?
Yeah, they were the ones, they were the stinky, smelly ones he raced in. And I still have them. I have them in my garage here at the house.
What happened to the running shoes?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you do? Right. Do they, I hope they're encased in some sort of odor-proof glass case now, or are they just stuck in a bag in a drawer?
They're taken care of.
That's great. So you don't bring them out occasionally and show them around?
No, I don't think I do that. I haven't done that in a while. I haven't had them out in a long time.
Pete doesn't remind you about them.
I actually reminded him about them when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame a few years ago. I said, "Hey, do you remember when you gave my son Andy your running shoes in the van when we headed back to Sydney?" And he goes, "Yeah, the Reeboks." And I go, "Yeah." And I go, "I still have them." He goes, "No way." I go, "I do."
Fantastic. So then there was the next story, right? So the walk-on music. I remember the first time I came to Kona, and you know, I was with Compi Trainer, so we had some VIP seats, and we sat in that sort of little enclosure they have there in the back of the car park at the Kincaid. And you come on the stage on awards night to your walk-on music, and I thought, how cool is that? He's got his own walk-on music. I didn't realize what it was at the time, and now I do. But then the bit where you're pointing at everybody, and I've watched you pointing, thinking, just like it says in the book, you just, "Hey, there's my mate Bob, and oh, there's Peter Reed there, I've got his shoes, and hey," and you're pointing at all those people. Now, come on, let's talk a little bit more about what that's all about, well, really, and how it developed and the pickle it got
I've
you.
I've always been a pointer. I pointed people at finish lines so they realize it's all about them. And so when I'd go on stage and I'd see somebody up front, I'd point at them like, hey, how you know, because I knew them. Then I'd point out to the crowd because it's to the athletes. It's all about them. This is their night. I'm pointing at them to signify that they are number one tonight. They're number one all the time. And so that's why I do it. So I'd point two or three or four times or five and I'd kind of stop when the music would stop. Then I'd walk over to the lectern, to the podium and start doing my thing. And then one night the music just kept going. I pointed like, I don't know, 12, 13, 14 times. And then the music stopped and I hear a voice say, I won. And I'm going, what the heck? So I'm walking over to the podium because I just kind of ignored it. I mean, I had no reaction to it and went on with the night. And then afterwards, I found out that a lot of the carnies and some of the pros like Welchie and Paula and the sound crew were taking bets at how many times I would point. And the winner would get free beer at the end of the night from everybody else. And I'm going, what? Are you kidding me? And Dave Downey won that night because he controlled the sound. He shut it off at the number 13 or 14, wherever I was at. So I'd stop. And that's why he won. I said, that's not fair. You guys shouldn't buy him any beer. So then I wouldn't stop pointing. You know, I'd keep coming on and I'd hear people in the background go, one, two, three, you know, how many times I'm pointing. I'm going, oh my gosh. So, but I still do it. My wife thinks she goes, stop pointing. Why do you point at everybody? And others go, that's weird. But it's just what I do, and I'm pointing out to the athletes, and I point to the finishers a lot of times. And, you know, in the olden days, people say, you shouldn't point. It's rude to point at something. But to me, it's an honor to be able to point at them because they're the ones. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, no, that did make me laugh. And, you know, equally, there were some, we'll come back to another couple of funny stories in the end. I've got a good one I'd like to finish on, but amongst some of the stories you'd written, I sort of had a personal involvement in at least one of them because you talk about Sarah Reinertsen. So she was the first female amputee ever to finish in Kona. But of course, she had that year before when she missed the cutoff at T2, didn't she? Which was heartbreaking. And I remember stood there right as they just turn off Lee Drive and into the parking lot there and just before they dismount and you know, she just missed the cutoff by a few minutes. So let's just talk about that for a bit. Tell your side of the story there,
you know,
Mike.
Here I am in the tower looking out down Ali'i Drive, calling people in. And I had thought about Sarah during the day and everything, but I really actually thought she was already off the bike and out on the run. Back then, we weren't getting you don't get the live updates like we do now. And so you just kind of trying to listen for your phone to ring or somebody to tell you something. All of a sudden, I heard all this kind of cheering and clapping and yelling behind me, which that's where the dismount line was. Mm. And I see Sarah there getting off her bike, and she's got her hands down on her legs and kind of keeled over. And I could tell she was kind of in a convulsive way and crying. And I'm going, what's going on? And I looked at my watch, and it's past 5:30 p.m., the bike cutoff. I go, oh, my God. She didn't make the bike cutoff. And I, you know, her training in San Diego, and that's where I live, and always following her and seeing her during the weeks a lot of times. And I was just, I was just really kind of devastated. I just felt so bad for her. And, you know, here there's a TV camera on her, and I just couldn't imagine what she was going through after all that training and that work. And she didn't do it. And I was like stunned and shocked. And all of a sudden, you know, I don't know if it was Tom Zivart or Whit Raymond, probably Whit, tapped on my shoulder, Mike, people are coming. So I turn around and, oh my gosh, here comes another finisher. And I'm jumping back into the mode of the positive. And, oh, you know, and I had to kind of blow that out of my mind on the Sarah side, but I couldn't get it out for the next, you know, half hour, hour or so. It was just kind of hanging there with me. But, you know, you keep up the strong positive screams and yells for those finishers. So I think I was all right there. It was just very difficult to do that. And seeing her later in the night, and, you know, her telling me she's coming back, it helped. That's for sure.
A couple of days before the race, she'd you know, I was, as I mentioned earlier, I was working for CompuTrailer then. So she stopped by the booth and she was talking to Chuck and Roger from the factory and talking about using a CompuTrailer. And after the race there, I think she realized that she needed to be stronger on the bike. So she enlisted the help of John Howard. Now, John's a previous, he was an Olympic champion. He was a world record holder on the track. He was, he'd won in Kona, hadn't he, way back in the 80s. And she enlisted the help of John Howard and used the CompuTrailer. And so we had an investment, if you like, an emotional investment in that returning years when she came back. And so when we saw her getting into T2 in good time and then making it to the finish line, that was just fantastic.
It was
for you as well.
You know, to be able to be there when she came in, it seemed like that year went by in 4 hours. All of a sudden, there we are there together again. And it just, oh my gosh, it's happening. It's here. There she is. You know, it was special. So special.
I always think, you know, at that moment when Sarah came back to T2, she must have known that she'd missed the cutoff. She would have seen the clock. But at the same time, you know, I know athletes who've missed it before, and there's a part of them that's hoping that one of the officials won't have noticed, or somebody says, "Oh, go on then," you know, takes pity on them and allows them to carry on. And, you know, for every athlete that doesn't make the cutoff, there's a marshal or an official there that has to give them the bad news. And they're people as well. And I always feel for them at that moment when they're having to, you know, be professional and deliver the bad news that somebody can't carry on. But at the same time, understanding all of the training and effort and emotions that have gone into actually getting somebody that far.
It's a very difficult task. Coming out of the water to have to tell someone that their Ironman day can't continue, or on the bike. The toughest for me is when somebody comes past that 17-hour mark, whether it's, you know, 20 seconds or a minute or whatever. And, you know, I don't yell out and call them an Ironman. They get their, Ironman still gives them a medal and a shirt, but obviously they're not in the official results. And I'll find myself walking up to them and go, you know, you are my Ironman tonight, because they still went 140.6 miles, and they deserve something. They deserve, you know, they deserve something. And to be able to give them that, a lot of times when I hug a lot of them, and it's difficult. I mean, my gosh, it's terrible.
I guess sometimes that time doesn't reflect, you know, the time that they've done, and the fact it's taken them 17 hours and 2 minutes perhaps doesn't reflect that the challenges and difficulties they've had in that day in actually getting to the finish line at all. They'd have probably been presented with multiple occasions when they could have pulled the pin and just quit, but they didn't. So, as you say, they still got the Ironman spirit. It's just that they just didn't quite make that time.
But it didn't make them any
less of an athlete or a person.
As I say a lot of times, you know, Ironman is, and endurance sports are forgiving. You may fail, but that doesn't mean you need to stop. You keep it up. It's your lifestyle, and you'll get to that finish line eventually. It happens. I've seen it happen over and over again of people, "Oh, Mike, I didn't make it last year, or I, you know, missed the cutoff or this or that, but I'm here. I'm back." And they're looking at me, "I'm back," you know, and I know you are. That's fantastic. So it's so great to see.
Yeah, another of the amputees, actually, that you talk about in the book,
yes,
is Scott Rigsby, an absolute tank of a man. Like you say, looks like a running back or something rather than a triathlete. And your story echoes a similar one to mine, because I met Scott Rigsby on that same year when he came the first time. And he said, "Listen, you know, if you're out there spectating on race day, Simon, and you see me sitting on a wall or something," he said, don't take pity on me. He said, I've probably removed my prosthetics and I'm sitting there. It doesn't mean I'm quitting. I'm just tipping the blood out so I can carry on, because it keeps squelching and rubbing around, and then the prosthetic doesn't sit." And I'm like, man, that's tough. You know, this guy's got no legs, but you forget about that. He doesn't have blisters on his toes. He just has blisters on the ends of his stumps. And just what some people are willing to put themselves through makes what the rest of us with full functioning arms
no kidding.
Seem a bit soft on occasion. But I think you said also that in order to get to that point, most of those guys that you talk about in the book have gone through so much more to actually get to the start line of the race.
You know,
the race in itself is probably nothing.
They're like all of us. They set a dizzyingly difficult goal for themselves. And is it more difficult for them because they do have a you know, disadvantage because they have a disability that others look at like, oh my gosh, that I'm glad that's not me and stuff. And as I said at the end of the Sarah Cliff and Rudy chapter, I don't know if these guys would change their, sure, they would not have liked to have had happened to them what it did, but they're now complete as a human because of what's happened to them, because they created that. You know, we're the cause of our own experiences, and they created their own experiences after the devastation of losing a limb. And now that experience that they've created is a strong, incredibly strong, healthy life. And they're passing their message on to others on a daily basis. So, you know, things happen to people for a reason. I truly believe that, even though some of the things are just absolutely devastating to them and their families. But if they believe they're the cause of their own experience, you know, after that bad point, good things happen. They create a strong human.
I've got a couple of questions left, Mike, for you. The first, I want to finish off with the funny story of Gary Baz. So I'm going to leave that for just a second. but my other question is, your final chapter said that you're blessed and for doing this, right? But let's go back all those years back to when you were running those sports shoe shops in San Diego and you were doing a bit of announcing at the weekend on some running races. If you hadn't got that call to go to Kona and if, you know, things had taken a different turn, what do you think you'd be doing now?
I'd still be in the endurance business.
Have you ever allowed yourself to think about that?
Besides announcing, I was a rep. I represented Saucony and Power Bar. I went to work and was one of the originals at Active.com and helped build that company. And so I no doubt I would have stayed in the endurance business to produce income. And I probably just would have done a lot of local events, you know, announced here in Southern California. But you know, I guess I've always created and I got something in my mind and a goal set. I'm going to go after it. I didn't have a goal to be the Ironman announcer. Sure, in the 80s, I go, gosh, I really want to go there. And it would be great to get on the microphone. And, you know, but somebody else had that reign. And when I got the call in 89, you know, you jump on something like that because I was being called up to the major leagues. I was on the pitch, so to speak, in the middle of the field. And they wanted me there. So, yeah, you know, it's hard to say what my path would have been. I know I would have stayed in the endurance industry because I have a passion for it and I love it. But if I'd never been the, you know, Iron Man guy or the voice of Iron Man, I don't think I'd be any less of a person than I am today. I would have probably found my influences and inspirations elsewhere.
Mm. Yeah, indeed. But here you are.
That's very nice.
We're all lucky to have you in our lives. You know, that's the one thing I wanted to say, Mike, is I have been fortunate enough to be called across the line by you and heard you say those words to me as I crossed. But you say you're the luckiest person in sport, but I also think that triathlon's been very lucky to have you as a part of it. So I, you know, if my fellow listeners and triathletes would allow
you're
me to,
I appreciate
like to
that.
Say
thank you
on their behalf.
You're welcome.
And so, but let's finish on a funny note. Like, Gary Baz, right? Gary's your mate. You talk about him in the book. You talk about going to Hot Corner. So let me describe Hot Corner. So that's the bit where, you know, these days you've got people coming along Pilani. You've got people coming down Kuakini. You've got people coming back in the airport. You've got people coming up Pilani. You've got racers that sometimes coming from all four directions. And right in the middle, you've got a little commentary post. And you're on the Hot Corner and you need to take a little break, a comfort break. So you ask your friend Gary Baz to stand in for you for just a moment. I mean, what could go wrong, Gary? As you say,
exactly.
He's always got a comment. So what could go wrong? I'll let you tell the rest of the story, Mike, because somebody told me you mentioned this story the other day, and they said they were absolutely.
It was 92, so only a few years into the Ironman gig. And Gary went over with my wife and I, Rose, and it's always great to have someone there who's never been involved with Ironman is just see the look on their faces of an event like that. So we're at the Hot Corner and it's still earlier in the day, but it was a hot day. So I was drinking a lot and I had to run to the bathroom and it was just behind us, only 20 yards. So I said, Gary, And Gary's very eloquent. He tells jokes better than anybody. He's a writer, journalist. You know, he's just this gregarious, fun-loving guy. And, you know, to hand him a microphone, I didn't even think twice. And I said, Gary, you know, he's been seeing what I've been doing. He was up there with me. Why don't you call him by? I got to go to the bathroom. Why don't you call him by real quick, and I'll be right back. I handed him the mic. Didn't even look at him. And I don't remember him saying okay, but I just figured. So I jumped down the scaffold. I get in the portaloo behind, and and I hear the sound coming out of the speakers that sounded like a funeral director. I mean, I heard number 4, 8, 5, number 6, 2, 2. Good job. And I'm going, what the heck is that? And I didn't use the word heck. I'm going, you know, I've never zipped up so fast in my entire life. I come busting out of there, and the first person I see is my wife, Rose, who's down on the ground looking at me like, get him off the, you know. And Rose is as good as, we all went to high school together. We're the best of mates. And I go flying up the scaffold, and I look at Gary, and he's white as a ghost. He's shocked. The crowd is looking up at me like, Riley, what the heck are you doing? What's going on here? I go, Gary, give me that. And I started announcing, doing my thing. And I kind of looked over at him. He was like shaking and, dude, I didn't know it was going to be that hard. And I'm trying to make him feel good. Forget about it. So we go through the whole day and oh my gosh, that night he had a few beers and we started laughing so hard about it. And this was 1992. And we were together on Saturday night. Our birthdays are just 3 days apart, and we're celebrating with everybody. And I told the story to his sons, his two sons who are in their 20s. And we just laughed again about it. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing how that came about and the look on his face. And it taught me a lesson like, okay, don't give that microphone to the uninitiated, because things like that could happen. And the best part of the story is Gary was one of the ones I chose to read my manuscript early on to help with mistakes or grammatical errors or anything like that. But I didn't tell him that was part of the chapter of funny stuff. And it was, you know, that's chapter 16. It's later in the book. And so I just waited, and it was like 3 days later, and the phone rings and it's him. I go, hey, hello. And he goes, You son of a, you know, and he just went, oh, what, are you really going to put this in there? I go, yeah, that was funny as that. He goes, oh my God. And then he wanted to change a few things, like, you know, with the way the story was. I go, forget it, dude. You ain't touching that. It's word for word. It's as is, and you can't do anything about it. And so it's in the book. It was amazing. Yeah, yeah, good laugh.
Well, at least you're still on speaking terms anyway. You still laugh about it, so it all worked out right in the end. But of course, you did hand the mic over to one other person on the finish line, didn't you? And that's in the book. We won't spoil that one.
That was meant
to
be.
That worked out much better for you. Yeah, yeah, cool. Well, we'll let the readers find out for themselves. So, listen, Mike, that's great. We could talk all day, and I'm sure that, you know, hopefully there'll be another book coming out called Finding My Voice Again or something, because it sounds like you've got double the amount of stories.
Well, let's get this one out. And keep in mind, just go to MikeRiley.net. It's got all the information on where you can buy the book. Obviously, all the regular online channels and all that good stuff. And that audio book should drop real soon. As I said, I did. Audible and others will have it. So, you know, enjoy it. I hope you get a copy of it. I think they'll like it.
Well, I've got my copy here. Actually, it's a PDF from you, Mike. It's the pre-launch edition, which you did ask me to keep quiet about. So I've read it. I've enjoyed it. I've shared it with my friends now that it's public. I'll be encouraging people to listen to this and then go out and buy a copy. So, Mike, thanks so much for being on the show today. Thank you for being a gracious guest. I really appreciated your time. Sharing those stories with us.
My pleasure, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
And being there for us all on the finish line. You're welcome. So, listeners, thank you very much for being here again. That was Mr. Mike Riley. You can find Mike's new book on MikeRiley.net. I'm sure it's on Amazon as well, but we'll put all that detail in the show notes. So thank you once again for stopping by to listen to us chatting with another fantastic guest. We'll be back again next week. So enjoy the rest of your week. Bye-bye for now.
That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swimrun events. As a SWOT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year, and on top of that we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWOT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page, and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWOT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.